Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha along with the articles and books about Jewish history that help illuminate those Parsha ideas. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. The struggle between Yaakov and Esav endures until today. This entire Parsha, the Ramban writes, and it's a fascinating Ramban worth looking up, is a blueprint and model for how the Jewish people should deal with their adversaries in exile, which is why the story's ending is so puzzling. After Yaakov flees from Esav, he is left alone. Vayivaser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov is all by himself. And what happens next? He has a fight. Vayeavik Yish Imo. He fights with a figure who never reveals his name. Yaakov is injured on his hip near a sciatic nerve. I will not let go of you, Yaakov says, until you bless me. Yaakov is given the name Yisrael. And as the Torah explains, all future generations are now forbidden from eating from the Gid Hanasha, the sciatic nerve, the place where this mysterious figure injured Yaakov Avinu. In his commentary on the Mishnah, his Perashat Mishnayos, the Rambam writes in Meseches Chulin, the seventh chapter of Meseches Chulin, the sixth Mishnah, there's a very famous Rambam who actually says that the reason why we do not eat from the Gid Hanasha is not because of this story, but because all of the prohibitions, all of the mitzvahs, mitzvahs sase, mitzvahs lo sase, the positive commandments, the negative commandments, were all repeated on Har Sinai. It is not because of this story. The only way that we can have an enduring commandment is not from the stories that are before Matan Torah, but are because of what is repeated by Moshe Rabbeinu when he received the Torah. But the prohibition, at the end of the day, of Gid Hanasha is presented as a part of Yaakov's story. It's nice context, but clearly, if it was not the actual foundation for the prohibition, then what is the message of including the prohibition specifically here? So, like, what are we doing? Just to give you more context, we don't do this with any other Isurim, generally. Why do we have the prohibition of eating from Gid Hanasha specifically given to us in the context of this story? Our Parsha is a blueprint for the Jewish people to thrive during Gullus and exile. So where does this story fit into that model? What exactly is the takeaway for future generations, and how should they handle adversity? Is abstaining from, you know, sirloin steak a part of our long-term strategy in exile? Sirloin steak is the classic cut of meat that is usually prohibited because the Gid Hanasha. Every couple months, they hear of a different butcher or somebody who knows how to take out the Gid Hanasha, so you can have the sirloin steak. But for all intents and purposes, I have never had sirloin steak, and I am not sure how that abstaining from the sirloin steak is a part of our long-term strategy in exile. What is the significance of this story, and what does the prohibition of eating from the Gid Hanasha have to do with this message? To understand all of this, let's explore a fascinating debate surrounding the Gid Hanasha that featured within one of the most controversial rabbinic controversies. I know I used the word controversial twice there. One of the most controversial rabbinic controversies in all of Jewish history. Most people thought that when Shabtai Tzvi, the infamous false Messiah, that when he converted to Islam in 1666, it would be the end of the controversy surrounding his messianic ambitions that swept up world Jewry. Of course, it was not. While many abandoned Shabtai Tzvi following his conversion, many elements of the movement moved underground. There were many who continued to privately and quietly hold on to the warped messianism that he so successfully stoked throughout the world. What exactly they continued to believe is really a much more complicated matter, but some element of their belief surely endured. I'm just going to leave it at that, but for those who have looked into this very carefully, one of the great mysteries is what was the belief of those who believed, so to speak, in Shabtai Tzvi after he converted, and certainly after he died? What exactly did they believe? Did they think he was coming back from the dead? Did they still think he was Mashiach? It is really not so simple, but that is not for today. Following the death of Shabtai Tzvi, which was on Yom Kippur of 1676, the next big controversy to surround his movement was undoubtedly the controversy between Rav Yonatan Eibschitz and, of course, Rav Yaakov Emden, that quite literally embroiled the entire rabbinic world. In February of 1751, the Jewish world was stunned when Rav Yaakov Emden accused Rav Yonatan Eibschitz of being a secret Sabbatean follower. There's a big debate. This isn't a big controversial debate, but how do you pronounce it? Is it Sabbatian, Sabbatian, Lo Yodea? I'm not sure. You could write in, send me emails how to properly pronounce the followers of Shabtai Tzvi. Sabbatian, Sabbatian. I'm not sure. Again, we're not going to resolve that today. Based on amulets that Rav Yonatan Eibschitz had written, as well as older suspicions that had followed him from before he really reached any major prominence, Rav Yaakov Emden was convinced that the most prominent leader within the Jewish world was a secret Sabbatian, namely Rav Yonatan Eibschitz, who undoubtedly was the most, if not one of the most prominent Jewish leaders at the time. Rav Yaakov Emden was not all that prominent. He was a massive scholar, Talmud Chacham. He had one weapon at his disposal, which was that he owned his own printing press, and he was not afraid to use it. I remember that when I was in yeshiva, I remember hearing from Rav Tzvi Berkowitz, I think he was quoting his grandfather-in-law, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that the yeshiva world has kind of deliberately distanced itself from this controversy. We try not to talk about it so much. Why? Because there really is no easy resolution in this debate. You're stuck either wondering how the acknowledged leader of the Jewish community could have possibly harbored Sabbatean views, which is like, it's unfathomable. There's no question that Rav Yonatan Eibschitz was a massive Talmud Chacham. He has Svarim on Halacha, he has Joshua's Crazy Uplacy. We know his works. How is that even possible to conceive? Which I believe comes back to that earlier question I posed of what did it even mean to believe in Shabtai Tzvi after he converted to Islam, certainly after he died, which I think most people do not even have the vaguest clue. They're not even an inch, they're not anywhere near figuring out the answer to that question, in my opinion. Or secondly, why a very serious Torah scholar, Rav Yaakov Emden, would ever make such a wild accusation to accuse the Gadol Hadar at the time of harboring heretical views of thinking that Shabtai Tzvi was the Mashiach. It's unimaginable. Much credit is due to Rav Yecheskel Landau, of course, the Noda B'Yehuda, who really charted the path in a famous presentation that allows for the esteem of both rabbis to remain intact. He's the one, I think, who navigated the Machlokas in a way that allows kind of contemporary Jewry to look up to both Rav Yonatan Eibschitz and Rav Yaakov Emden, even though in their Machlokas at the time, it was mutually exclusive. You can't hold of both. It was impossible. It was the Noda B'Yehuda, and credit is due to both Professor Schneer Lyman, who is all over today's presentation, his articles, and we of course have links to all of these articles. Don't make fun of me for plugging my Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. All of the Schneer Lyman articles are linked there, and you can of course find them on the Lyman Library, as well as the PhD of David Katz, our favorite historian, who has a podcast of his own, and I'm sure many people listen to. He's phenomenal. He wrote his PhD on the Noda B'Yehuda and is very worth reading for the chapters that talk about how the Noda B'Yehuda navigated this disagreement. But really, credit is due to the Noda B'Yehuda. The most detailed and accessible account of this controversy appears in my dear friend's Rabbi Pinny Dunner's book, which is called Maverick Mystics and False Messiahs, which includes a 60-page chapter on the Emden Eibschitz controversy, as well as important suggested readings. You could look at his conclusion where he goes through, you know, all the readings and academic works that informed him. Most of the other treatments of this history are either in very academic works, and of course that includes the works of Professor Schneer Lyman. You can find all of them on the Lyman Library or on the Substack, or there's another phenomenal scholar named Pavel Malchenko, hard to pronounce name. His stuff is phenomenal on this, really, really the very, very best that I found. All the other good stuff is unfortunately in Hebrew and academic Hebrew, which is very hard to get through. One fascinating chapter in this debate revolved around, you guessed it, the Gid Hanusha. The Gid Hanusha was not an insignificant prohibition in Sabbatian thought. There are 365 negative commandments, and in Kabbalistic works, each prohibition corresponds to a different day of the year. The prohibition to eat from the Gid Hanusha, these mystical works explain, corresponds to the day of Tisha B'Av, when we mourn the destruction of the temple. And this day, in Sabbatian thought, Tisha B'Av, it was transformed into a holiday given their messianic claims, and that they would kind of take Tisha B'Av and transform it into a holiday to subvert Jewish law was a central part of the Sabbatian movement. It was also Shabtai Tzvi's birthday, of course. He was born on Tisha B'Av, and that was the day that corresponds in Kabbalah, in mystical works, to the prohibition of eating from the Gid Hanusha. Of those 365 negative commandments that we have, each one corresponding to a different day in the year, the Gid Hanusha corresponds to Tisha B'Av. In his classic article, of which most of this history comes from, which is entitled Rabbi Jonathan Eibschitz and the Porger, I think that's how you pronounce it, Professor Schneer Lyman details how the Gid Hanusha became a part of this rebellion rabbinic controversy. Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz, who was a master porger, what does it mean to be a porger? That's something called nikor. He was able to take out the different nerves that are prohibited from eating from animals. And he was an expert in removing this sciatic nerve from animals. And he writes in his work that someone approached him. He writes this in the Crazy Uplacy, that somebody approached him and suggested that the Jewish people have been avoiding the wrong nerve. They all have it wrong. And to disprove this concern, Rav Yonatan Eibschitz says, no, we have the right one, because he marshaled a proof that the one that you think it is, it can't be the right one, because he quoted from the Smag, who writes that this prohibition is for men and women, and the nerve that this traveler identified was only found in male animals. So, Rav Yonatan Eibschitz reasons, it cannot in fact be the correct spot of the Gid HaNasha, because we know in Halacha that the Gid HaNasha is for men and women, and this alleged Gid HaNasha that you think is correct only appears in male animals. Now, for those who are listening correctly, and those who are familiar with Halachic language will understand why this disproof is nearly laughable. When a halachic work writes that the prohibition is for men and women, it means it is binding upon Jewish men and women, not that the prohibition can only be found in male and female animals. So how on earth could Rav Yonatan Eibschitz make such an obvious error in saying, I know that this can't be the real Gid HaNasha because this only appears in male animals, and yet we know in halacha that Gid HaNasha is both for men and women. The two things have nothing to do with each other. The prohibition is for men and women not to eat from the Gid HaNasha, but that has nothing to do with whether or not the Gid HaNasha actually appears in male and or female animals. It is, at first glance, what would seem to be a laughable mistake. When Rav Yaakov Emden heard about this, he ascribed much more nefarious motivations to Rav Yonatan Eibschitz. Of course, Rav Yaakov Emden reasoned, Rav Yonatan Eibschitz knew that the prohibition for men and women refers to the Jewish people and not to male and female animals. It must be, rather, that Rav Yonatan Eibschitz was willingly trying to get the Jewish people to violate the prohibition of Gid HaNasha as part of his alleged Sabbatian views. This is what Rav Yaakov Emden accused him as a larger part in his polemic against Rav Yonatan Eibschitz, that he found a smoking gun in his halachic writing from the fact that he dismissed this suggestion that this is the correct Gid HaNasha that we need to avoid because it only appears in male animals. This is laughable. There's no way. He must be actively trying to get people to eat the correct Gid HaNasha as part of this inverted view that Sabbateans had towards Halacha and the significance of the Gid HaNasha corresponding to Tisha B'Av. This must be part of that larger plot. If this claim seems outlandish, and in some ways it is, it may be because we still do not fully appreciate the lengths to which secret Sabbateans went to hide their affiliation. Still, as wild as it may seem, this caused quite a serious stir. It is one of the only accusations against Rav Yonatan Eibschitz that emerges directly from his published halachic writings. In a somewhat covert maskilic work known as Toldos Adam, and I say covert maskilic work, it is supposed to be a biography of the brother of the Vilna Gaon, but there's a lot of maskilic stuff in there, and there's a great article by Edward Breuer called The Haskalah in Vilna, Rav Yecheskel Feivel's Toldos Adam, which kind of surfaces a lot of the covert maskilic ideas that are contained in this alleged biography, but the author does point to this specific incident as a reminder that even great rabbis like Rav Yonatan Eibschitz can make basic errors in reading texts, which is kind of this like more modern progressive. Even rabbis make mistakes, and he pointed directly to this incidence. Others, like the Chassam Sofer in his Tshuvos on Yoredeya, if you look at Simon Samach Tes, which again I do have linked to in the Substack, tried to contort themselves into justifying Rav Yonatan Eibschitz's read that the prohibition relating to men and women bears upon the existence of the Gid HaNasha in male and female animals. And he goes through some very creative halachic reasoning. It's hard to say that the suggestion of the Chassam Sofer is what was animating Rav Yonatan Eibschitz, but you can look it up yourself on your own and see if it convinces you. More recently, there was an eye-opening article by Moshe Haberman, who wrote an article on the Sfarim blog, an extensive article trying to definitively prove that Rav Yonatan Eibschitz was in fact relying on a very real guide of Hilchos Nikor, the laws of how to remove the sciatic nerve, that did in fact fact, identify the Gid Hanasha as something that had to appear in both male and female animals. And it was a printer's error that obscured and kind of blamed it on the smog on a different work when, you know, the abbreviation for Sefer HaNikor, whatever it was obviously mistranslated and ended up turning into the smog or some other halachic work that allegedly Rav Yonason Eibshitz was relying upon. That article raised a few eyebrows. It's really fascinating because he thinks he found the actual copy of this work that belonged to Rav Yonason Eibshitz. But in a follow-up, a stunning article of Sfarim detective work. I mean, it's still unfolding. You got to read this stuff. It's just phenomenal to see Jewish history, an old story, really continue to play out in contemporary times. In a stunning article of Sfarim detective work, my friend Ellie Fisher, who you may know, responded that he remains unconvinced by Haberman's suggestion because he actually went back. He's an expert in tracking the provenance of Sfarim, who they belong to. And he says, I think he may be mistaken. And this was not, in fact, the actual copy that belonged to Rav Yonason Eibshitz. You can check out both of those articles. They appeared on the Sfarim blog and are linked to in our Substack. The Emden Eibshitz controversy remains one of the most painful chapters in the history of rabbinic leadership. The more you look into it, the harder the proper approach becomes. Professor Schneer Lyman concludes that the Gid Hanasha story is likely just a product of Rav Yaakov Emden's overzealous concerns about residual Sabbateanism within rabbinic wings. This is not the smoking gun. There are other issues that perhaps Professor Lyman is more sympathetic to in one of his many articles that he has on this controversy. He does not think that this was in fact a smoking gun and maybe was a product of that overzealous concern about the continuation of Shabtai Tzvi. Who was right about the larger controversy? Unfortunately, we may never know. Which brings us back to our parsha and the actual role of Gid Hanasha. There's a beautiful quote from Rabbi Sacks that invokes the words of our parsha where he writes, reflecting on the death of his own father, "Sometimes all the pain and the tears lift you to a much higher and deeper joy when you say to the bad times, I will not let you go until you bless me." One of the hardest parts of Gullus, of exile, that is often overlooked is trying to figure out what does Hashem want from us? Without the direct word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of God through prophecy, we have to rely on our Masorah, the tradition of Jewish thought and practice that have guided us through millennia. But exile can cloud that as well. How do we know what the correct approach is when rabbis from within our Masorah to argue? Without prophecy, how do we muster the clarity to proceed with confidence? Like Yaakov, exile can make us feel incredibly alone. Yet even in the darkness of Gullus, of exile, even hobbled because of the injuries we have sustained throughout the generations, we are able to continue walking. That is the message of the Gid Hanasha. Even after the pains of Yaakov's lonely battle, we know that the Jewish people will never be abandoned completely. The Gid Hanasha explains in the Hamak Davar, which was written by Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv, in his commentary on Chumash, the Hamak Davar, he writes that the Gid Hanasha is a reminder for the Jewish people to remain resilient and flexible even after sustaining pain and injury. Even after the pain and the suffering of exile, we have to remain flexible and resilient. Even though we have endured so much suffering, the Sefer HaChinuch writes, we remain certain that we will never be completely lost. The Sefer HaChinuch, in the mitzvah of Gid Hanasha, he writes, and I'll read it in Hebrew, "Meshorshei mitzvah zu kedei shetia remez li Yisrael she'af al pi sheyitzvelu tzaros rabas begolias miyad ha'amu miyad b'nei Yisrael sheyu betuchim shelo yovedu." We will never be abandoned. We will never be completely lost. Yaakov's name is transformed to Yisroel, and Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. The eternity of the Jewish people will always endure. And that is the enduring message of the Gid Hanasha, that even when we feel alone and we're wondering, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what do you want from us? We're looking to leaders. We don't know what the right path is. We don't know what the right way forward is. We feel levado. We feel alone like Yaakov. We're able to grab onto our adversaries and say, we will not let go of you until you bless me. And we're able that even though we're hobbled, even though we're in pain, Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, Knesset Yisrael, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, the Gid Hanasha is the reminder that we will always have the capacity to continue walking forward. So thank you so much for listening. Another reminder, if you haven't had enough already, to subscribe to our Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com, where you can find all the links to the Shabbos reads, the books and articles that we mention throughout this shiur. Thank you again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I am so grateful to your friendship and support. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading every single Shabbos.